Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Chef Danny Lohr.
St. Patrick's Day is just around the corner, and we're celebrating with some Irish-inspired food today. We're reinventing your typical mashed potato recipe with some rutabagas, and learn how to make your own corned beef. We're going green in more ways than one on today's episode. It wouldn't be a true St. Patrick's Day without a frothy beer. These days, more and more people are exploring the art of home brewing. Earth Eats' Josephine McRobbie has more.
As the American Home Brewers Association tells it, in the beginning, there was beer. It was good. Well, maybe not right at the beginning, but people have been making their own beer, batch by batch, for over 10,000 years. Modern homebrew clubs and associations have been going strong since at least the 1970s. There were 800 such clubs in the U.S. as of 2009. Author and beer columnist Rita Kahn says people are passionate about making their own beer because of the possibilities it allows.
It is a craft that has three basic ingredients: water, malt, and yeast. And you can do so many different things with those to make flavors of great complexity.
And in many ways, today's home brewers are working in the same way that those in ancient Europe did, by adding earthy ingredients such as honey, herbs, and fruit to their concoctions. Stout beers are perhaps the most often experimented on. There are variations infused with chocolate, coffee, lactose, oatmeal, and even oysters. David Ray is relatively new to homebrewing. He's made about 6 batches. He says the appeal of homebrewing comes down to the ability to make something that's unavailable in the marketplace.
With homebrewing, you can do basically whatever you want. So it's not, you don't have to go to a store and be like, oh, I want this, but it tastes like a little off. You can just go in and craft something that is exactly what you want it to taste like.
But with great freedom comes great responsibility. One misstep and that ale you've been working on can come out flat, strange tasting, or even worse, overcarbonation can cause bottles to explode. And it's for this reason that beer makers thrive on communication with one another.
It's one of those things where you can do it all by yourself, but if you really want to get better, there's people who have made the mistakes you're going to make. So if you talk to them, you can maybe not make those mistakes or do something a little bit different and just come up with something better.
Sustainable practices are also a concern of many who brew their own beer. Rita Kahn says she knows homebrewers who grow their own hops, use cans or recycled bottles for their products, or pick local berries to add to their batches. Beer doesn't grow on trees, but for homebrewers, it's a pretty short trip from backyard to bottle.
And I know that my life's been a failure.
For Earth Eats, I'm Josephine McRobbie.
Just watching the bubbles in.
We'll hear more about homebrewing in the coming months, so keep listening for that. In the meantime, you can follow the latest on local food issues on our Twitter feed or become our friend on Facebook. Just look for Earth Eats. It's still a little bit chilly outside, but it's not too early to start thinking about your garden, believe it or not. This season, why not try planting some potatoes?
Right around St. Patrick's Day, I fill up my baskets, and these are, you could use any type of basket, whether it was plastic or terracotta or one of these old wooden orchard baskets, and fill it up with a nice composted material, and then you plant your potatoes in it. Now, the way that you you plant potatoes is you get seed potatoes, and you cut them into little pieces, and you always want to have each piece have a few of the eyes on it. And then you let those dry out for a day or two so they build kind of a little barrier, a moisture barrier. And then you plant them kind of eyes up into your compost. The great thing about this is that they're so easy to harvest. That it keeps a lot of the moles away from them because they're protected. And when you're ready to make that potato salad for 4th of July, they'll be ready. All you have to do is dump the basket out and you've got a bunch of potatoes.
Perhaps the promise of potatoes come summer will inspire you to get gardening, even during these cold days. For our recipe, we're pairing the potatoes with a root vegetable for our rutabaga mash.
So these are the rutabagas, and again, this is one of those very intimidating vegetables. You go to the market and you don't know what the heck to do with it. You know, so a lot of people just walk right on by, like the old song goes. But they're very, very easy to use. In Scotland, they call them nips. A classic Burns dinner is the haggis with nips and taties, which are mashed turnips, or rutabaga, and mashed potatoes. It's got a firmer flesh than a turnip. A turnip is more watery. This is a little more crunchy. I'll let you taste a little raw.
Oh, rutabaga.
Get that sweetness at the beginning, and then it gets a little more aggressive towards the end.
These are big suckers. They're waxy, too.
So with these, we're just going to cut them up into uniform pieces so they all cook the same. You're going to trim off the exterior, and the wax is there to keep them fresh. You know, there are a lot of vegetables that they treat and they wax that you really need to be careful with, like such as, you know, even lemons are often lightly waxed to seal in flavor. So if you're going to use the zest of a lemon, it's always good to buy an organic, untreated lemon. But almost all rutabagas are waxed, and it's very evident that they are waxed. Okay, and then we'll just set these aside. And what I've done is I've already got some cooked. I cooked them about halfway in water, and then drained them off, and then added some chicken stock. And this is what my grandmother Orr used to do. And I'm just going to cook this down a little bit.
They look like little peaches. They have sort of a soft peach color now.
Yeah, as they cook, they turn a little bit darker. And then over here, I've got some potatoes that cook the same way. Okay, I'm going to add a pinch of sugar and a little bit of lemon zest. Okay, Grandma didn't put the lemon zest in.
This is your touch.
But that's my touch. Okay, I'm going to add these to the potatoes. We have about equal amount of potatoes and rutabagas. I'm going to add a little bit of butter, okay, and a little bit of heavy cream. Okay, I'm just going to take a whisk and I'm going to start mashing it up. And I'm not going to mash these up too much. I don't really want a puree. I want kind of a rustic mash.
There's nothing that warms my heart more than a big bowl of mashed things.
I'm
very excited about this.
Okay, and that is our mashed rutabaga, Grandma Orr's mashed rutabaga and potato side dish.
The tears and the sadness you gave me when you said goodbye.
Megan Meyer joined us in the kitchen this afternoon. She's our resident root vegetable lover, so I wanted an expert's opinion on this dish.
So I want a little bit of these herbs here. Oh, goodness. The butter is dripping off in rivers off the top of this mound of mashed rutabaga. All right, here we go.
Oh, she's got such a little smile on her face. Rivers of butter and heavy cream, she should say. It was really, really just that good. Give this dish a try and let us know how you like it. Send us a note to eartheats@gmail.com.
Kind of friends and a
perhaps the most Irish of all dishes is corned beef and cabbage. If you're interested in trying your hand at this staple dish this St. Patrick's Day, here's a recipe to get you started. And at the dinner table, you can regale your guests with the history of corned beef.
It was a method of preserving beef when they did ocean travel. So what they would do is they would stack the beef with the corning spices in barrels, and that would be the ballast of the boat, and they would ship that, and they would take that out and boil it all together and make a boiled dinner. And you think of corned beef and cabbage as being an Irish dish, but it's actually an Irish-American dish. They experienced the corned beef on the trip over in the boat. They found the corned beef very satisfying and a really kind of a celebration. We think of it as not a real classy dish, but when done right, it can be a wonderful celebration.
For this dish, we're using local grass-fed beef from Fiedler Farms in Rome, Indiana.
And you can see that it's fairly lean for a brisket. The little fat that there is fairly thin. It's a fairly thin cap of fat. If you had bought a, you know, regular kind of feedlot type of beef, there'd be about an inch of fat on top of it. You'll also notice that the fat has a slight yellow tinge to it, and that's very stereotypical of grass-fed beef.
Mr. Jim Fiedler was in the restaurant dropping off the brisket for our recipe today.
It's just something about going outside on the farm and being out there with all of the animals and the woods and the rolling hills there of southern Indiana along the Ohio River that just is inspiring. It just makes you feel better about being alive.
He told me that he took the farm over from his father and he had to work with the cattle that came with it.
And what he had was a herd of old English-based cattle, the smaller cattle of a mix between Herefords and Angus, and some were red, some were black. And a fellow from Purdue who was more traditional came down and said, Well, if you want to get rid of this herd, I know somebody will buy it because they'd make great grass-fed beef. So I said, well, let's do it ourselves. And we just decided to stay small, and we've kept the cows small, which is one of the secrets, and then we decided to do it healthy.
Healthy meaning they're grass-fed, no antibiotics.
They're grass-fed. They get no corn, no corn finishing. We don't give them corn any time in their life, so it keeps all of the omega-3s and the vitamin E's and all the CLAs are fats that are in the animal that come from grass. And we're doing everything as healthy, as sustainable, and as certified humane as we can.
You can listen to my complete interview with Jim Fiedler online, the beef man who recently, reluctantly, gave up vegetarianism. Hear more from this interesting character at eartheats.org. So, we're in the kitchen, obviously, but even with all the hubbub, the prep process for the corned beef was quick and easy.
All right, so what we're going to do is make a corning paste. And people wonder what, you know, corned beef is. They think it has something to do with corn, but it's actually the peppercorns and the seeds. They used to be called corns. So it has some fennel seeds, we have some cumin seeds, some allspice, and allspice is a little bit bigger berry, so we crush that with the back of a knife to split it up, and that will release the essential oils and bring out that flavor. We have some Coleman's mustard, some crushed red pepper flakes, we have some fresh crushed coriander seeds, and we're going to add some paprika. I want you to smell this paprika. This is a Spanish paprika, which has a real smoky aroma to it, and it's also a little bit spicier than your typical paprika. It's going to give a nice flavor. And then I'm going to add about a half cup of salt. All right, I'm going to add some wet ingredients to this. Okay, I'm going to add some white wine. I've got some white wine vinegar. I'm going to add some Dijon mustard. And this is going to make a nice paste. Okay, and then we're going to add some fresh thyme leaves, which I'm just going to kind of scrape off the stems, but throw the whole stems in there. Okay, and then if you can find it, you can add some pink salt. And pink salt is what's going to keep the beef a little bit pink when you cut into it.
Mix that all together and make a gloppy paste, then lather it over the meat. Massage it in a bit.
And we're going to let that sit for about 4 to 5 days, or even up to a week and a half, 2 weeks.
You'll just get
more and more flavor. And the spices and the salt will work its way into the meat. And it will actually release some of the moisture, dry the beef out a little bit, and that's how the preserving goes. It's, you know, anytime you have moisture, that's where spoilage can take place. So when you take the moisture out by salting or drying, then you're going to have a product that lasts longer.
This really requires some foresight and pre-planning if you're going to do this dish.
Yeah, but then you've got a product that will last. You could, once you take it out of the mixture, you could use it right away, or it can last several days in the fridge before you use it. And then what I'll do is every day or two, I'll turn it over and, you know, let it all sit down into the brine. So I want to keep mixing it and turning the meat so it gets evenly spiced. Once you take the corned beef out of the brine, you put it in cold water, bring it to a boil, and you add some of the juice that comes out as it sits. And that's going to give your liquid a really nice flavor. You cook the corned beef until it's tender. It probably will take about 2.5 hours. And you just want to be able to stick a fork into it, and it should be really, really tender. And then you take all your vegetables and you put them right in that same broth. So when you're cooking them, they're going to absorb the flavor of the corned beef. And then serve it on a big rustic platter. I like to accompany it with some freshly grated horseradish, some really nice pungent mustard, crusty Irish soda bread. And you've got yourself a wonderful St. Patrick's Day meal.
The list of all the spices and goodies that went into the corning paste is on our website, where you can also see photos and follow all the happenings in the local food movement all week long on our blog. That's all at eartheats.org.
Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com, online at goodsforcooks.com.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
And I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.